Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Jeanette Parker. I'm Medical Whistleblower, and we're coming to you live from Lawrence, Kansas. We have a very, very nice program scheduled for you today, and I have again with me Dan Haley, who is the public spokesperson for Whistleblowing Airline Employees Association. And Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning, Jeanette. How are you this morning?
Yeah, well, we got some really wonderful guests with us today. We have guests from Australia, guests from England. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what we're going to do today?
Sure, because it is an interesting group. You'll have to excuse me for just a second. I'll explain how we all happen to meet on different parts of the earth here. As you said, our association, the Whistleblowing Airline Employees Association, does have a website at www-whistleblowers.org, and there's a contact page on us. And several weeks ago, Captain Tristan Lorraine, former British Air 757, contacted me via that page, and he's co-chairman of the Global Cabin Air Quality Executive. It's a grassroots organization that represents airline air crew and other employees around the globe, about 500,000 people, and he was soliciting our support in publicizing their effort while trying to gain media and political traction in the States. We researched his organization, and we discovered the massive global media coverage that aerotoxicity issues was getting, but we also realized that in the process Tristan had actually written a book and produced a movie. He's the author of Toxic Airlines, and that's at www.toxicairlines.com, and the producer-director of a full-length documentary film, Welcome Aboard Toxic Airlines.
Right.
Additionally, we were connected with two other grassroots aerotoxic groups in the UK, and our organizers will be on the program today.
Gremlins. Don't worry, no, but they're all chatting anyway.
Talking in the background here,
you're
but around the
mobile,
time frame. Another
shall
one
I ring
you
and tell you when to ring in?
FlyersRight.org contacted us via email and expressed a desire to work with our group, recognizing the our shared concerns.
I think you'll be on in about half an hour, so I don't think there's any urgency, but it's very difficult to know how it's going to be.
Between our groups, here we are all today, and that's about all I wanted to say, unless anybody has any future comments they want to add to me. I'll hand it back over to you.
Oh, dear. Yeah. All right. Listen, I've got to go because they're talking, all right? Okay.
You guys are live, okay.
Yes, okay. Well, that was an interesting conversation, whoever it was. And I'll just hand it back over to you, Jeanette.
Let you do
the introductions.
We have Captain Susan on the line with us. Are you there, Susan? Oh, we've got another person coming in here.
Thank you very much for raising this very important issue.
Right. Well, perhaps, Jeanette, you could introduce Kate and John, and she'll
Kate Hannah is the executive director of FlyersRights.org and has been seen many times on national TV news. She talks about commercial aircraft ground delays and other passenger rights issues, and her organization, as well as other passenger rights groups, have formed a global coalition representing passengers' concerns. And Kate, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi there. How are you
doing?
Go
right ahead, Kate. Sorry for the disturbance in the background there.
Yeah, no problem. We are a global passenger rights concern. FlyersRights.org has a hotline where people can report any type of aircraft or airline situation that they would like to deal with, including, and we have had calls and messages from folks who I've spoken to who have gotten sick from the fumes in aircraft. Although that hasn't been our primary focus, it's clearly an issue, and clearly something that I would guess the flight attendants and pilots who are risking exposure to that every day would definitely want to make sure that they and the passengers were held to a higher standard of safety.
Well, it's really an important issue. And we also have Captain John Hoyt on the phone as well. Are you there, John?
Yeah, hi, Jeanette.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your group and why it feels this issue is so important?
Okay, well, I was a British Airspace 146 airline captain from 1989 to 2005. And, well, pretty much as soon as I started flying the aircraft, I had very strange neurological problems. And you should know I'm a really fit guy, long-lived parents and good genes and all the rest of it. So so back in 1990 about, I had really serious problems. So I had poor memory and speech impediment, confusion, brain fog, you know, all those sort of things you don't want as an airline pilot. And I just couldn't work it out to start with. I remember walking around a German supermarket one day and there was visual disturbances, and I just got very, very concerned. And but, you know, you just put up with it. You fly the aircraft, you follow the checklist, and I went on like that for about 10 years or so. And then I thought, well, I was night flying at the time. And I thought, well, I've got to stop night flying. I've got to go to day flying, because clearly that's the problem. And that's exactly what I did. I went to day flying in 1998, so that's over 10 years ago. And the problems kept with me, really, same aircraft, and it just got worse and worse, really. And, you know, in 2004,
so
I actually walked off.
When did you
find
out what was causing it?
Well, nobody told me, and that's the point. I walked off an aircraft in 2004. I was really sick, doubted my ability to fly, and had 3 months off, you know, rest, and the doctors didn't mention anything about it. They just said, you're stressed, it's, fatigue and all that sort of thing. So I went back to flying for another 6 months, and then, you know, the symptoms just came back and got worse, and I just packed it in mid-2005. And then, 6 months of confusion, nobody told me what was going on, and I eventually got grounded for chronic stress. And I thought, well, okay, I'm not a stressed sort of guy, but that's okay. That was early 2006. And then literally a matter of weeks later, I was, Captain Tristan Lorraine got in touch, and he invited me to take part in some medical testing along with about 26 other pilots in the UK. And
mm-hmm.
I was quite nervous of it. I didn't know anything about the subject, and I agreed. And within weeks, I'd had confirmation that I had engine oil in my blood.
Oh,
and that was the point.
They did it with a blood test, not a
yeah,
fat
blood
test.
And fat. Yeah.
Oh, yes, usually it's accumulated in fat. Okay.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And this was nearly a year after I'd stopped flying, but it's still there, clear as day. And I remember the day very well. And I'm a fairly skeptical guy, like most pilots, but that made my mind up. I'd begun to work it out by then, and I was just horrified. And all those previous years, I suddenly realized what had been going on. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that many, many other pilots around the world, in Australia and so on, the States, the UK, had the same issue. And I thought, hang on, this is outrageous. And I guess I got pretty angry at that point in mid-2006, and I decided to do something about it. So, that's how the Aerotoxic Association started to happen, really, in 2007. And that was in an effort to stop other people going down the same road that I'd been down, really.
So you did finally figure out what it was, but is it likely to resolve and go away at this point?
Well, I haven't flown now for 4 years, and for about 2 years after I stopped flying, I still had serious problems. But I have to say, a couple of years later, I've got my speech back, as you can hear, and I can think straight and all the rest of it. So I've been reasonably fortunate, but I have real health issues still. And just to show that, I went on holiday recently and did a big walk in the French Alps, and got really sick for a couple of weeks as the toxins in me sort of accelerated around my body. So, this is the sort of thing the doctors need to work out, really, how it affects individuals. And we all have slightly different symptoms, obviously, but I've got absolutely no doubt whatsoever as to what caused my problems for all those years.
And John, Dan,
well, Kate, have you been hearing this kind of problem a lot from passengers?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the primary issue that comes to us, but I would say it's a relevant issue, and partly that's because folks don't know that we would be dealing with that. so although we say please report to us any type of issue that you've had with an airline, most of the folks who've mentioned this to us have been almost insecure about reporting it. But this one woman who contacted me that I'll never forget, her husband's a dentist. They live in Oregon. And she already had a compromised situation with her health when she was exposed for 3 hours to these fumes.
Mm-hmm.
And the fumes were in San Francisco, so it wasn't like a snow event. It wasn't like they were in a de-icing line. It was just they were sitting on the tarmac for about 3.5 hours. And she got so ill that once they got to San Diego, before getting on their cruise, they couldn't go. She was so ill, and it's had permanent damage for her physically. I actually have letters from her doctor showing this. So I think it's a very relevant issue. I think it's something that many people don't know about. They're not sure who to go to have a voice, and I think that's extremely important.
Can I interject something here? And, Kate, that's exactly the point here, and I'm sure Susan Michaelis and Judith Morosky will emphasize this. It's these lengthy cabin delays where people are breathing, that exactly your issue there, where they're breathing this toxic air, and when they get off an airplane and walk away and they start feeling these things, they can't go back to passengers and say, hey, did you get sick from that flight? They just assume, hey, I must have eaten something on the airplane, or I've got some kind of an illness. So it's a matter of heightening public awareness here on the issue, but also having a communication medium by an organization such as yours, where they can contact you and you can collate the data and say, hey, we've got a problem here. And I'll back off and go ahead, Jeanette.
Well, I was going to possibly bring in Samantha Sepetino. She was a passenger on board B-767 aircraft traveling from Florida in 2007 with four other family members, and she was immediately stricken ill once en route, even though she had been originally in good health. And I'm going to have her join us here.
Jeanette?
Yeah, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about your story and that of your family?
Yeah, basically we was all well and fine, and we went to London Gatwick Airport to board a flight to Florida Orlando in February 2007. During the flight, my six-year-old daughter went pure white and violently vomited everywhere, complained of a bad smell, and instantly fell asleep. At the same time, the other family members, including myself, had severe headache, fatigue, diarrhea. I had a burning sensation at the base of my throat, and these symptoms continued on. When we got to the villa, I felt paralyzed. The headache pains were very severe. I was vomiting. The children was not well. My husband was not well. Which led to emergency medical visits from doctors, who then rushed me into hospital and said my blood oxygen levels were low, I wasn't breathing properly, all the lung walls, were wheezing. It was just horrendous. I can't remember a time where I felt so ill. And they couldn't find anything normally that was wrong, as in no pneumonias, no infections, no viruses, and none of the steroid treatments that they were giving me, the injections, the breathing, oxygen and everything, was making any change to my lungs. Anyway,
they were treating you symptomatically because they didn't know what actually caused it.
Exactly. And I was due to fly home as well, so I mean, this had been going on for a while, but we saw the emergency medical people pretty much straight away, and she was coming back from the house, and then she admitted me, and then when we got back to the airport, when we went back to the airport, we got a delay and then cancelled of 27 hours for the flight. And there it was that I found that lots of other people had become ill with the same thing. People had blisters on their faces. It was all breathing.
It was a very extensive contamination of the air, wasn't it, to affect so many people?
Well, yeah. I mean, I didn't know it at the time. I just presumed that we'd been stricken down with something and was thinking, like, when I get back home, I've got to go straight to the doctors and follow this up, because nothing was easing off, which I did do, and my GP, he examined me and said my lungs was not normal and referred me straight away to specialists, consultants. I obviously registered this all with the airline and tour operator, and we started getting conflicting advices from them about what actually happened on the aircraft. I then tried to contact all the aviation organisations, including the HPA, CAA, FAA, Aviation Health Unit, which apparently didn't exist in the Civil Aviation Authority's eyes at that point, and it took me a month to find out that that department actually existed, in which time we were still all going under medical examination and trying to find out and figure out exactly what was wrong with us. And then it was diagnosed by several consultants, chemical exposure and nervous and neurological system abnormalities, all sorts of problems, really. It's really, really, really damaged our family.
Well, it's a very horrible thing, and obviously, especially when you don't know what's causing it, it makes it even harder to treat.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the main point. You're trying to find out from the airline what happened to us. The Environmental Health Agency ruled out food poisoning because the food was supplied from two different sources, to first class and economy passengers, and some of the passengers affected was not, you know, didn't eat anything, so the food poisoning issue was ruled out pretty quickly. And you're talking about 40 plus passengers with the same symptoms.
Yeah, well,
that's
clearly an incident that they could trace to it being involved with the...
Yeah, but they would not, under no circumstances, carry out an investigation. The CAA refused. I contacted a member of parliament to write officially to ask for an investigation to be carried out, and not one of them would carry out an investigation, and just completely refuted everything all the time.
Well, do I have Susan Michaels on the phone at this point?
You do.
I'm going to hop off Jeanette, and Dee should be calling
so
in.
So, Susan, can you address how the air gets contaminated?
Yes, absolutely. This is a problem that has been known about since the 1950s, when aircraft designers decided to use air that came in through the engines. And what happens is a certain amount of that air is taken off before it goes into the combustion chamber. It's bled off so that it can be piped up the side of the aircraft and used to supply cabin air. Very simplistically. And what's happening is that by design, oil seals that keep the engine working are allowing a little bit of oil to seep into that air supply. And that's happening at certain stages of flight. And it's just probably very small amounts by design that many of us may not even be able to detect. But on top of that, there's maintenance issues. So then a larger amount of that air with the oil may be more apparent to people on a more regular basis than we've ever really thought about. So we've got two issues here, a design flaw that is taking air in through the engines to supply air to the cabin, and then maintenance issues. And what in effect is happening is that passengers who are breathing the same air as the crew are known to have been breathing oil with that air since at least the first reported case we know about goes as far back as 1977, when aircrew were incapacitated in flight and they decided it was this synthetic jet engine oil and that urgent investigation was warranted. And we're now 32 years down the track, and that investigation to any satisfactory standard has not taken place. So in actual fact, there is a vast amount of data out there showing that this problem's going on, and the denials from the airline industry have continued over the decades, and one
one investigation after another that is really just sidestepping the issue and designed to delay the process of really addressing this issue. And it's, to my mind, on the scale of the cover-up, on the scale of big tobacco or asbestos. It's not in terms of health, perhaps, the same things, but in scale of cover-up. But there are two major issues here, and that is pilots and cabin crew breathing oil in flight cannot do their duties as they're required. And if I'm doing a study and in fact, research on this, I've published an 844-page reference manual, and I'm doing a PhD on it. The data is there, and it shows that flight safety has been seriously compromised on many, many occasions. It's documented, it's well known, and in addition to that, there is this short-term and chronic health problem that many are now terming erotoxic syndrome. So it is a major, major problem that anyone who flies an aircraft needs to say, we want clean air now.
Well, Susan, can you tell us a little bit about your own credentials? You're a former Australian pilot with over 5,000 flying hours, and you're currently now serving as head of research for Global Cabin Air Quality Executive, right?
That's correct. I was flying in Australia from the mid-1980s, and I was perfectly healthy, and then I hopped on the BAE-146. In my case, over 3 years as a pilot, and I repeatedly smelt the oil. It was well known in my airline that it was oil. One of the other airlines in my country was investigating it and had been doing so since the 1980s, but they hadn't told us, and I repeatedly got sick short-term in flight with a variety of symptoms, and after 3 years of that, my health failed. And I've never flown since, and that was 12 years ago, and I still suffer very serious health injuries today, 12 years later, and I'm hearing the same story around the world. So that led me to doing research, which I commenced because I knew it was the oil, so I knew that I had to find out about it because my airline wasn't doing anything to really rectify the situation. I wanted to go back to work. And my research gathered so much evidence that we had a Senate inquiry in Australia into this. There were inquiries in America, in England, and the industry got involved pretty much to bury the issue, to make sure that none of this really came out. And then I started acting as the researcher for the Global Cabin Air Quality Executive, which is the air crew body that's been set up globally to deal with this issue and to really look at the issue and demand that action be taken. And I'm also completing my PhD on this. So the evidence is there. The industry have no end of reasons why this issue is appropriately being addressed at the moment, and that's anything but the truth.
And you've recently authored a book on this that people can read, Aviation Contaminated Air Reference Manual. How can people get a hold of that book?
That's correct. That is distributed. They can go to my website, which is susanmichaelis.com, SusanMichaelis.com, and get it there or order it through their libraries. But that's a reference manual. And what my colleague Tristan Lorraine has done to make it a little bit easier for the public is he's made a documentary, which is Welcome Aboard Toxic Airlines, and that has a website as well, being the name of the documentary. And that's been broadcast in a number of countries around the world and has received wide acclaim. And that's basically telling the story from his point of view, covering all the main issues. The people that you're speaking to on your show are actually all on that documentary. And for the public, that's probably one of the best ways to get an idea of what the problem is. And that's also in NTSC. But it's
and your website,
a global scandal.
Your website, that you're the head of research, can you give that website?
Yes. The GCAQE is www.gcaqe.org,
and that's the research body. And we pretty much look at, you know, all the issues, the research behind this, and we're pulling together scientists and independent experts from around the world, trying to get them to help us. To date, we've had no effective government funding that has really been addressing this issue, apart from possibly the medical protocol that's been put together through the FAA. That's very good, and Judith can tell you more about that. But apart from that, there's been a lot of research from the industry and government, but it's all pretty much to avoid the real issues, which are very simple. Oil is leaking with the air into aircraft, and that's causing dangerous in-flight incapacitation, impairment, and serious health issues. And through my research, I've found alarming rates of ill health, and I've now found a cluster of pilots who are, in fact, no longer with us. And like the Gulf War illness, they're linking a number of cancers, brain cancers and so on, to the neurotoxins and organophosphates, and I'm finding that in my research. So it's very worrying.
Now, Captain John Hoyt, are you still on the phone with me?
Hi, Jeanette, yeah.
I want to get a perspective from England here. You live in the UK, and you served as a training captain on BAE 146 aircraft for 15 years. And you're currently president and founder of Aerotoxic Association. Can you tell us a little bit about your organization?
Yes, well, obviously when I found out about the scale of the problem and started to talk to other people, I just really had to do something about it. So I set up this association, aerotoxic.org, and it's been running now for 2 years. And, you know, I like to feel I've helped many people in the last couple of years, particularly aircrew who have contacted me. And, you know, it's a strange business. You often hear from them and then they go off and take the information and either stop flying or keep going. I have to say a lot of people, you know, once they work out what's going on, they stop the exposure and stop flying, and that's the best thing to do, really. But passengers, of course, going back many years, they've had unusual, uncharacteristic illness, and they don't quite understand it, and then suddenly they begin to work it out, you know, the cause of certain illness in the past, and, you know, it basically boils down to the fact they got on an aircraft well, and then they get off really sick, like Sam talked about earlier, and it can affect many people on a single flight, obviously.
Yeah,
and that's what I've been doing.
People, yeah.
Sorry, Jeanette?
In Samantha 17,
yeah.
It was 40 people.
Yeah, absolutely. It affects, you know, we all get the same air. But I have to say that I know many friends and colleagues who have not had a problem. They've flown the aircraft, and they look at me in astonishment. They say, well, I haven't suffered. And I say, well, good for you. But I know without a shadow of a doubt what caused my problem. And, you know, it's just not acceptable for this to still be going on, for still people to be grounded for chronic stress and mental health problems, when really what's going on is they've had multiple exposures to oil fumes. And as Susan was saying, if you pump organophosphates into a confined space, then for many thousands of hours, that's what happens.
Well, these organophosphates are neurotoxins, and so they do affect cognitive abilities. And when the toxin has not been identified and the route of the toxin exposure is not known, doctors can easily mistake these symptoms for other things.
Absolutely, and that's...
Kate Hannah, I want to say something about this idea also that, you know, for me not to know that there was an organization about aerotoxicity is interesting, because we as a group have been fighting for and are aware, and the EPA website, Environmental Protection Agency, posts that in 17% of the major air carrier's water that has been tested, there's true coliform. So it surprises me very much that there is not some government investigation behind this. The EPA website goes as far as to suggest that if you are a child, elderly, or in any way health compromised, you should not drink airline water. I'm very surprised that we don't have this kind of disclosure based on the air quality, because this clearly is an issue.
Yeah, we don't want to be telling passengers not to breathe the airline air. I've got a new caller here on the line. Who do we have now?
Oh, hello there. It's Sue Dale. I'm having to ring you on my mobile today.
Hi, Sue. How are you doing?
Hi.
Okay.
My phone just died on me, I'm afraid, so I'm ringing on a different number.
You want to tell us a little bit about your experience? You're the founder of the Toxic Free Airlines.
That's a public information site. Yeah, because, like John, I wanted to stop this happening to other people because I was blissfully unaware of what was going on. I was cabin crew for over 25 years, and the crew are not made aware at all that there is a problem. And I've had flights where passengers have been projectile vomiting uncontrollably, not being able to make it to the bathroom. And we didn't know why. We had no idea. I filed a report saying, could you check the water? Is the water contaminated? Because they hadn't had the same food. And we were completely kept in the dark. And my health had been deteriorating for over 12 years. And my doctor was as mystified as I was. He tested me for everything under the sun. And he had no idea why a previously extremely healthy person was just going downhill and getting everything wrong. And until I heard about this problem, nothing made sense at all. I'd spent hours on the internet looking up every weird and wonderful illness under the sun, and the symptoms never quite fitted. And then one day I was off sick yet again, and I walked into my local newsagent's, and there was a newspaper there with an interview with Tristan Lorraine in it, and it said, toxic fumes in all jets. And I just stood there completely stunned. I thought, that's it. That is what the whole of the last 12 years has been about. So I got hold of Tristan's phone number and I phoned him and I began to discover what on earth was going on. And then I soon began to discover that all my colleagues were ill, but we hadn't been telling each other. And the scale of the problem is absolutely massive, which is why Toxic Free Airlines came around. And we started to do a crew health survey, and we've now got about 810 surveys back. And crew are suffering from very, very serious illnesses. This isn't just sore throats, diarrhea and vomiting. You know, crew have got liver damage, kidney damage, cancer. We've got cancer in young people in their 20s. And still, there's an awful lot of crew out there who haven't got a clue. Every time they go to their doctor, they're told they've got a virus. And they're just not getting the right treatment. So we do need more
awareness. But they're not being tested. They're not being fat tested. Toxicities, which is, you know, from a medical standpoint, is one of the best ways to assess whether you're not you've been exposed to jet oil fumes.
Absolutely, those tests are only available privately in the UK, and there's a lot of people who can't afford them and they don't know about them. If you go and see just an NHS doctor, he'll say, "Oh, you've got the symptoms of a virus or food poisoning." And when you present with the later stages, the fatigue and the apathy, and you're getting these neurological problems, then you're prescribed antidepressants, and they say you're depressed. Even I know crew who've taken all this information about aerotoxic syndrome to their doctors, and they're still prescribed antidepressants.
And that's very counterproductive because petrochemicals are usually detoxified through the liver, as you pointed out. Many people suffer liver damage. And also these antidepressants are also liver excreted, and you have to have good liver values in order to be able to even handle the psychotropic drugs, because they are also detoxified. Their metabolism, they're lipotrophic, and they go through the liver. And so, therefore, you're putting extra stress on the liver to detoxify the body by adding these other drugs that have to be taken out of the system through the liver metabolism. So
exactly.
It actually slows your ability to repair your body's situation and to take care of the toxicity because of the level of excretion for both is the same through the liver.
Yeah. And certainly cancer is appearing to be a very big problem. In the airline I used to work for, we're losing, on average, one crew member a month to cancer, and the average age is 44. So when the airlines say there is no evidence, there is evidence. They just don't want to investigate it, and they just don't want to find why these crew members are getting cancer at a rate 10 times the UK national average.
So this is an epidemiological study possibility to look at the effects on the air crew, because obviously they're exposed much more than passengers are. But also somebody who's a passenger who flies many times, a business traveler who flies a lot,
yeah,
might also have a lot of exposure. Isn't that true? Kate, do you want to address that issue? Are you still on?
I'd be quite happy to address it. It's Susan here. We made another documentary in 2003, and that is also on the same site where all the other documentaries are. It was done through my organisation I set up in 2001, AOPUS, bringing together people, public and crews, trying to deal with this issue. And that had many doctors talking about this issue, and it also had passengers on it. And we've done that again in Welcome Aboard Toxic Airlines, and the passengers there are... It's not just air crew, it's also the passengers. We've got passengers who are on one flight, like Samantha, like Angie, who has been is in the United States with severe neurological tremors, and other people coming forward with neurological problems after one flight. And then we've got the frequent flyer also, who has come forward and said, I was flying regularly and I kept getting sick, and it's exactly the same story as the air crew. And they couldn't keep going with their job in many cases, so their lives are being thrown upside down, just like the air crew. So I wouldn't like to say anymore that it is just air crew and they fly more often, because as the scientists, some of them are saying, it's individual susceptibility amongst many other factors that is of concern. And it's not just the organophosphates in the oil, it's the mixture of chemicals with the organophosphates. And they're heated, and they will act synergistically, and no one's ever tested for the heated mixed product in a reduced pressure environment. So testing the products on animals, drinking the oil is cold, is of no relevance, and therefore it's absolutely nonsense for the airline industry to rely on science and government committees to say, but... the levels we've found in the air are suitable and safe, because comparing them to animal studies, we think it's okay. It's not okay, and there's a huge amount of evidence, and it's very, very worrying, because...
Well, I spoke to a doctor who's a specialist in toxicity, who is in our group, and she works in environmental toxins and knows a lot about petrochemicals. And she indicated, obviously the route of exposure in this case is inhalation, taking in air that is toxic. And, of course, you take in air most frequently through the nose. And this particular chemical, they are lipotropic, in other words, they are soluble in oil, and therefore they rapidly go through the mucous membranes into the cells, and because of that, they get caught in the nose cribriform plate, the membranes of the cribriform plate, and get sent directly up through the pathways directly to the brains, a very quick a route from nasal passages right to the brain up the olfactory nerves. So my understanding is that there's a direct route right to the brain with these chemicals, and they are neurotoxins. They do pass through the blood-brain barrier. In addition to that, breathing in this kind of material would possibly place it very deeply into the alveoli of the lungs, which, of course, has a very, very thin membrane for exchange of vapors, because we, of course, exchange oxygen and CO2 across those barriers to have the lungs work properly. And that's one of the reasons why the effects of these chemicals are so rapid and so intense. And so obviously oral ingestion is not the same route as ingesting it through inhalation.
Well, this is correct. What we're finding is that it's not just neurological damage, it's also respiratory damage. Other areas that we don't fully understand, but it's basically also a chemical injury to the brain, the scientists are telling us, and the evidence, the documentary evidence is there. we may not have been able to do major epidemiological studies because no one will provide the money for that to be done. But there are enough case studies and there's enough testimonies from experts from around the world. And we had a major conference just in 2005 where we brought many of the world's experts together in London. And that book has also been published. And they did not say it's all okay. It's quite the opposite. But there is a huge amount of information. And in fact, the press, it's phenomenal. And it's on the AOPIS website under AOPIS press articles, AOPIS.org. In the press articles, we've been collating data on this, and the media has been following it since the 1980s. And there would be almost 1,000 articles there. So, you know, the media is not oblivious to this issue, and it's a telling story is the major aircraft manufacturer that said to me and to Tristan Lorraine when we were making the documentary that he was aware that there was a problem and they weren't addressing it because they weren't getting hurt in the hip pocket, and what had to be done was the passengers had to speak out. When the passengers said, "We want it fixed," and started hurting them economically, then they would fix the issue. And that's the bottom line. The passengers have to say they want clean air. And until then the crew will not have enough of a voice because it's the passengers who pay the money to keep these planes flying. And we want the planes to keep flying. We just want the air filtered, and we want detection systems on board those aircraft so that the air becomes safe again.
Well, I think I have Judith Murawski on the phone. Judith, are you there?
Yes, I am. Yeah, good morning.
She's the co-chair of the Global Cabin Air Quality Executive, and you are an industrial hygienist, and so therefore you're specially trained in regards to environmental toxins that may occur in Pearson's workplaces. Can you tell us a little bit about your work?
Oh, sure. Well, I've been working largely with flight attendants and some with also pilots and passengers for almost 10 years now who have been exposed to oil fumes that are supplied to the cabin and flight deck on regular commercial flights. This is nothing different, nothing special. This can all the people that it happens to think that it will never happen to them until it does happen to them, and then it becomes very important to them because their lives in some cases are very seriously affected. Some people are no longer able to fly and are disabled by the effects of exposure to these toxins. And there's a real spectrum as well. There are some people who may have an exposure that's perhaps a lower level exposure, or their body is able to handle that extra load, and perhaps they're off work for a couple of weeks or they don't feel well for the next few months, and then they're back to, you know, normal. What feels like normal, and then there are others who are disabled by the from the toxic effects of these exposures for years, and some of them I haven't seen them get better, so I don't know if it's permanent or not, but certainly it's long term. And to me, the real issue is that the airlines are currently under no obligation to provide information to passengers or crew, exposed passengers or crew, and I really believe strongly that that needs to change. It's unbelievable that you can have a whole crew go to the emergency room and a handful of passengers, and those passengers are not being informed of what they were exposed to and what the potential toxic effects may be. And that really needs to change. It's amazing that the airlines have this information. They know about the effects of exposures, and yet they're not required to share that with people who pay for a ticket or are, you know, employees and are getting very sick.
Well, I think we have a couple more persons who have been exposed here. We have someone here from the UK. Do you want to speak up?
Do you mean me, Jane?
Yes, go right ahead,
yes.
Jane.
Yeah, okay. I got on a Virgin flight to New York in 1998, perfectly healthy. And I don't remember anything untoward happening on the flight, but I may well have been asleep. But when I got off, I realized my hands and my feet and my face were very swollen, and I felt very uncomfortable. And when I looked in the mirror at my face, I was appalled. I could hardly see my eyes. I'd never had anything like that in my life before. That gradually subsided, and then about 3 or 4 days later, I discovered I had quite a severe pain under my ribs, right the way across under my ribs, kind of over where my liver is. That lasted a couple of days. And at the time, all I could think was that if only I could get in touch with those other people who'd been on that flight, because it can't be only me. But, of course, I had no way of doing that. Then over the next few weeks, the pain in the liver disappeared, but I had a lot of pain started in my hands and feet. It felt as if all the little joints in my toes and my fingers were hot and swollen and sore, and I still have that to this day. That's 11 years ago. And it just so happened that shortly after this, I happened to read a tiny little article in the Guardian newspaper about organophosphate poisoning in aircraft. And as soon as I read it, I thought, well, that just has to be it. There was no other explanation at all. I went to see my doctor, who knew nothing about it at all. He did blood tests to see if I had rheumatoid arthritis and lupus and things, and everything was negative. And it sort of carried on much the same for another year. I went back to the doctor, more blood tests, still everything was negative. And then I work as an acupuncturist, among other things, and when he told me that the nearest diagnosis he could get was fibromyalgia, I thought, fibromyalgia, I know how we can deal with that. We give up wheat and dairy, which I did, and the symptoms eased a great deal, and they've been much better ever since, thankfully, until just recently. I don't know whether there's any connection, but just shortly after a flight back from Helsinki, my hands and my feet started to hurt quite badly again, much the same as they had done originally. They're hurting right now. They have been for several months now. And at one point, two or three years ago, I was told I had very high levels of metal toxicity in my body. And, you know, I had absolutely no idea why I had them, because I haven't got any mercury fillings. But, you know, it all seems to add up.
Well, do we still have John on the phone?
Yeah, hi, Jeanette.
John, can you explain why there might be heavy metals in jet fuel?
I'm not the best person to talk about that, I'm afraid. I'm a pilot. But I gave a talk in Oxford a few weeks ago, and the last caller, Jane, she came up and said, hey, I was made ill on a flight 11 years ago. And this is what's happening over and over again. People come up to you and say, yeah, I had a similar situation. And that's the point. You know, people are just beginning to identify the reason for their very serious ill health, you know, many years ago. And that's really concerning, I think. And they simply don't know about it. I mean, Jane, as you heard, read about it in the newspaper at the time. But, you know, and they keep touching on it, but nobody seems to address it. It's not really on the main sort of stream at the moment. Concerning.
That testing for heavy metals might potentially identify this?
Absolutely. Yeah, we all have private testing, and it shows all sorts of things. You know, recently I had some blood testing, special stuff done in America, and it still shows brain damage and central nervous system damage. So, and that's true of most aircrew, I think, really. But if you go to the NHS, National Health Service, and have blood tests, it just shows everything's normal, but it's far from normal.
Samantha, can you talk about what they might have done for testing to identify your situation?
Yes, I had a range of tests done, including neurophysiological, neurological, and they identified nervous system damage, neurological abnormalities. I also had these fat and blood tests done, which they identified high levels of heavy metals, some trace of OP, but I didn't have them done until 16 months post-exposure. So as I understand, the organophosphates, or the trichlorosyl phosphate, is very, very quickly leaves the body. You know, it has a very short half-life. So unless you have that test done within days, you're not going to pick up the full extent of that.
Tony, are you on the phone?
Yes, hello.
Hi. Do you want to talk a little bit about your situation, what you,
your
own sure.
experience? Sure. I started flying in 1998 for the airlines,
mm-hmm.
and 2000-2001 I started on the BA-146, the RJ-100 aircraft. Everything was okay for a few years, although, like a lot of pilots, I think I was often suffering from fatigue. But in, I'd say around about 2007, I really started to get symptoms. For example, the fatigue was getting a lot worse. I started to get cognitive problems, short-term memory problems, you know, trying to remember if I'd done checklists or this kind of thing in the aircraft. And also, I was getting very lethargic, generally losing interest in things. Also, after duty, I've noticed I'd be starting to get lightheaded. I'm suffering from tinnitus. Yeah, these things started to...
Now, tinnitus means ringing in the ears,
right,
for those who don't know. Yeah.
Indeed. And, yeah, I'd say the last 10 months of my flying, before I, you know, was grounded due to being too sick to fly, all the symptoms were getting worse. Additionally, I was getting more kind of physical symptoms like tremors. Muscle twitching, I was having trouble with my speech, kind of slurring words or problems finding, you know, words, the right words to say. And again, the cognitive problems were getting worse. So problems concentrating, problem solving, understanding complex procedures, that kind of thing, which obviously is not what you need when you're, you know, flying an aircraft.
Now, how did you how did they identify this as a petrochemical toxicity? Did you have fat analysis or blood tests or?
Yeah, I had a specific blood test, which showed up benzene derivatives in my blood.
Oh, okay.
And also another caller mentioned heavy metals,
mm-hmm.
so they found nickel and cadmium in my blood, and
okay.
These are things. Nickel and cadmium on the compressor parts of engines, where the bleed air comes, you have nickel cadmium plating. So I think that's a pretty good explanation of where that may have come from.
So it's very clearly that one can point to direct testing that can identify possible exposure.
Indeed.
And so there's really no reason to assume a person is lying about this problem,
no.
or it's all in their head, because you can test for it, and it's very clear that cadmium is not normal in blood samples.
No, I mean I think
but I would just say that there, that the airline would say, well, I mean, you could have been, you know, you could be soldering in your spare time, and then this autoantibody test that's available in the States. It shows neurological damage, but it doesn't give the reason for the neurological damage, and the doctor would have to go through a differential diagnosis and rule out other causes. So I think it is difficult. I mean, I think it's great that you were, Tony, were able to get a clear, you know, relation between exposure and illness from the test that you had. But I think that in most cases, it's very difficult for people to make that case, and I think that's going to soon change with the blood test that's being developed for the organophosphate additive in the engine oils by Professor Furlong here in Seattle in the States.
Yeah, indeed. In my case, the airline were clearly not going to admit any liability, so they were saying, you know, I could have got these chemicals in my blood from other places or the other damage to mitochondria function, which explains lack of energy and that kind of thing.
Right.
But I think when you look at there's some tests done, I think it was in 2005, with a whole group of pilots, and they all had a very similar profile of chemicals in their blood and damage to various systems. So I think on this kind of evidence, it's pretty conclusive.
Yeah, I agree. And I encourage people to get the testing and to create that paper trail and to go to the doctor and document the fact that you have the symptoms and to write to the airline and copy your MP and the CAA and everything else. You need all this to create this paper trail. If you don't report it and if you don't get some medical attention, then it may as well not have happened.
Sure.
And you may not get proper treatment to make your life better as a patient with a health problem. Judith, do you want to step in here and give us your perspective?
Oh, I just did. Do you want some more of my perspective? I hope I didn't cut you off, Tony. I just really emphasize the need for people to report these events. The passenger, Jane, that called earlier to report to the airline, to send a letter to the airline, to send a letter to your MP, to copy the Civil Aviation Authority, even if you don't get a response or you feel like you may as well write that letter on soft, perforated sheets of paper, it's still important to document that and to be on the record for reporting it because the airlines can otherwise get away with saying, well, it's not happening and we're not hearing from anybody, so therefore it's just a few people and it's in their head and they're imagining it.
Captain Hoyt, what do you think? Do you think in the UK they're also trying to deny it? The airlines are trying to act like it didn't really happen?
Oh, absolutely. Just recently there's a newspaper article and summarizing the situation, and you get quotes from the Civil Aviation Authority saying there is no evidence. This is just astonishing after so much evidence over so many years. They're just in denial at the moment, and it's very sad, that they're jeopardizing the health of so many, innocent aircrew and passengers in particular. So it's just it's a waiting game, really, waiting for the, as
the
Judith
reason,
was talking about.
John, sorry to cut in, but the reason why the CAA don't have the evidence from the passengers is what I experienced was the brick wall that you face when you're trying to lodge a complaint, when you're trying to get an investigation going, and they just don't want to know. So any normal passenger that's on their own hasn't got the backing of a lot of other passengers, which is a rare example in my case, will be fobbed off and sent away. And this is what is happening, and that is why, these organisations are the airline's guard dogs. They're not on the passenger, crew or pilot side, what they're supposed to be. They're guarding the airlines, they're protecting them, and basically, no one's going to get through unless they're very persistent. Sorry to cut in, but carry on.
No, you're absolutely right. And weren't you told, Sam, that when you phoned up, you were the only person to complain and everybody else had the same...
Correct. When I told them, they actually printed in the national press that I was the only person to complain when I had other passengers on my same flight, written correspondence in front of me that they'd copied me into, that they had written into the airline as well. So, that was a blatant lie in the national press.
Well, we have a new caller from the United States. Are you there?
Yes, Jeanette, are you bringing me back online here?
Yeah.
This is Dan. Yes. I wanted to inject something into the conversation here that I think is important, and I've been talking to Kate Hannay about this. And basically, especially since the post-9/11 period, in some of our earlier programs, we had, I don't know who's talking in the background there, but anyhow, our earlier programs, we were talking about suppression of air crew members and reporting safety issues, and this definitely is a safety issue. And with the economically distressed airline industry, what passengers don't realize is economic, legal, and political pressures that have been brought to bear on the airlines, threatening liquidation, coupled with this fact that air crew members only get so many hours of a sick list, and companies monitor their sick list, so they might be even reluctant to call in sick. And when it comes to a major issue like this, first of all, most air crew members aren't apprised of the situation. It wasn't until I read all the literature that I was astounded in the widespread media coverage was given on a global basis. If they became aware of this and recognized that it's pervasive throughout the industry, there still might be this reluctance on their part to come forward and report it for fear that they might be isolated as a troublemaker, a whistleblower, or a big mouth. And we've already discussed my situation and the other pilots who have tried to report other safety issues out there and what happens with perhaps a hostile work environment, forced psychiatric or medical eval, where they can label you with some kind of an illness and usher you off the property, or you're no longer a threat. The other side of this is the powerful forces we're going up against here, on K Street, Wall Street, pressures they exert on politicians, plus the aircraft manufacturers, the airline industry. And I believe it was Susan who had mentioned this issue about smoking and how long that was kept from us, and how they labeled cigarette packs saying, warning, smoking may be hazardous to your health. Well, it's up to an individual if they want to continue smoking. But everybody's got to fly on airplanes. And if this problem exists...
Can I get Captain Michaelis here? And how about a UK perspective in regards to retaliation of persons who try to report this problem?
Oh, there's an absolute denial that it's going on, and anyone who speaks out, pretty much has come in for a very hard time. In Tristan's case, for example, he and another pilot were labelled as the two troublemakers in their airline reporting these events. Now, the sad, very sad fact about it is that Tristan had to stop flying. His doctors advised him to stop flying, and he did, and he felt very uncomfortable with his airline. He's now medically retired and can no longer fly. They found the additive in the engine oil in his blood. The other pilot is sadly no longer with us and died of brain cancer in January, and he had reported these ongoing symptoms all along. So we've heard story after story of pilots being given a hard time, called into the office, denied their medical insurance. So there's a huge incentive for aircrew not to speak out, and those that do had a very hard time in general. But the sad thing about this is that it's not only a health problem. If you spoke to a pilot that was the captain of an aircraft in Sweden, he no longer is able to fly because of the same health effects. But as it shows on the documentary, he can tell you about the night flying over Sweden when he thought they were going to not be able to land, not make it, because he and his co-pilot were so intoxicated by these fumes. And this is what I've documented throughout my reference manual and my research, that this is serious impairment to the point that the crews are so badly impaired they are lucky to have made it on the ground. And I cannot say, we don't know whether some airline crashes may have been related to this, because they don't test the air and they don't test the people. So people need to think about their safety.
Tony, can you come in a little bit and talk about, from a pilot's perspective?
Yeah. Sorry, what do you mean? What do you want to know?
In regards to impact on cognitive abilities, the quick thinking a pilot has to do in flight, and how this might impact the safety of the entire
airplane. Sure.
Airplane
this,
crew.
This whole thing with the contaminated air, it seems to affect the working memory. In so much as your short-term memory, for example, remembering if you've done checklist items, or sometimes trying to remember if we've been cleared to land, or this kind of thing, or problem solving, or looking at complex procedures, a complex departure procedure which has got lots of different turns and things to do in it, this kind of thing, quite difficult to take that in and process it, or the workload's getting busy in the aircraft, just generally keeping up with things. And latterly, I was finding I wasn't really keeping up with things, and was just finding it really hard work to keep on top of, just the sort of progress of a normal flight, in a busy work phase of flight, the landing or this kind of thing.
Jane, can you bring Kate back in?
Jane, how do you feel this kind of toxicity affected your ability to think and process information?
She may have clicked off, Jeanette, because
she's not still there.
On the line full period. But can I just continue briefly, and I'll put duct tape on my mouth here and hopefully give Tate a chance to come in here and inject something. But, given what we've seen in the past, and from what I understand from Susan and Judith, their statistical data on this begs to differ a great deal from what the government is producing, and yet they won't all pull together on the big table and discuss this matter. And the concern is, even though Congress is addressing this problem, we don't want to see a big label on the side. We're not trying to scare people off the airplane with this. We're just trying to heighten public awareness that this situation exists, and we don't want to see a label on an airplane that says caution, boarding this aircraft may cause physiological and or neurological damage to your health. But that would be the Band-Aid approach, just warning people, but they have to fly. And somehow this needs to be addressed. And I was glad to see the CNN news clip the other day on Terry Williams, the flight attendant that filed suit against Boeing. They are picking up on it in this country, and hopefully future newscasts like that will bring it to public light. And also, Kate Hannay, in my discussions with her, and she, I would like her just to mention briefly her September 22nd meeting that they're having in Washington.
Go ahead, Kate. And I think she's dropped off here.
Okay.
But one thing is there are sensible solutions that can be enacted. You know, they can look at making less toxic oils. They've known about these problems for 5 decades. It is possible. They can look at putting detection systems in the aircraft, in putting filters as to filter the air as it comes off the engine. They can, you know, look at studies at what actually is going on with the people. They can look at the engine oil seals and the maintenance and the design. After all, we must not forget that the FAA some years ago put out a notice saying that, in fact, because there were no detection systems on aircraft, no aircraft was, in fact, airworthy, because the one legal requirement for an aircraft to fly is to be able to ensure that the air is clean. And because there's no detection system, they made the comment that no aircraft was, in fact, airworthy. And that is quite a strong comment, and it has to be addressed. And there is enough data there now for those that are independent and want to have a look, and this problem has to be addressed, and the public has to take some responsibility to say we can't just leave it up to other people. They have to get on board and speak out through all sorts of manners and say we want clean air.
We have somebody new from England on the line. Go ahead.
It's Suzanne again. It's not somebody new. I just wanted to reply to something Jane said earlier on. She said after her fume event, when she felt so ill after her flight, she wished she had a way of getting in touch with other passengers. And that's what we've tried to provide passengers with at Toxic Free Airlines. There's a register online, and you can log the date, the flight number, the aircraft registration if the passengers ask for it. And you can put all your details there and all your symptoms, and then other passengers can see that and you can get in touch with each other. So it's a good way after a fume event for people to get around the data protection laws that we have here in the UK, which means everything's kept quiet, and you can share this information with each other, and then you can group together and do a group complaint, which will make it much, much easier.
Would that be helpful, Samantha? You're still on the phone?
Yes, definitely.
How would you have felt about that?
Well, as I said, in my experience, it was a rare circumstance, but we was all grouped back together anyway, so we was able to take each other's details. So not very often does that happen with the travelling passenger that gets sick on board flight. So for that reason, that's why that website is there, and it's a very, very good idea, because if you're a passenger alone, you've experienced all these symptoms, you don't know why, you go to the doctors, you don't get explanation, you contact all these organisations, the CAA, etc., and you get fobbed off, then you give up. And that's why they haven't got the evidence that they need to have, you know, that they should have, because you're washed away, as I experienced. Had it not been the fact that I had the knowledge of all the other passengers that had the same symptoms of us, I probably would have done the same. So knowing what we've been through, knowing what all the passengers have been through, I mean, we've had suicide attempts in teens, in children. We've had all sorts of problems, neurological and physical, and it has just been a horrendous couple of years for all the passengers involved. So, you know, there is support out there, so definitely passengers should push if they feel something's not right, and get in touch with the people that that can help.
And what, as a passenger, would you want to see our governments do? I mean, either in England or in the United States or in Australia or anywhere in the world. I mean, how do you feel that governments should respond, legislative governments?
As a passenger, how I'd want the government to respond is to to force all the airlines to make them buy all these 787 Dreamliners, which Boeing have introduced, and no longer is the cabin air going through the engines. So that should solve the problem eventually. But, you know, until all the airlines own one of these aircraft, which could take up to 30, 40 years' time, then, you know, there's going to be future victims, which is why we've taken our case to court, which is why we filed our suit against aircraft suppliers and construction in the States in January.
And Captain McKellis, what do you think they should do? What should we ask our governments to do?
To take it away from the vested interests, to set up independent, to listen to the experts from around the world that have already talked about this and have documented so much data, recognize that there's a problem and take a number of steps to address this. Look at the people, look at the oil, look at the detection systems, the filtration systems, and a whole range of other things. Get the word out so people are aware of what can be done. Educate the medical personnel. Mm-hmm. Enact the medical protocol so the medical fraternity is all aware of it. There's a whole host of things that can be done, and it's I know the data, I know the evidence, I've looked at it for years. It's absolute negligence to delay taking action any longer. To look at research in order to defer to science and avoid having to do anything is no longer acceptable.
What about flight surgeons? I mean, should they not have special training and understanding how to detect this, because this obviously is something very important for flight captains and crews?
Absolutely. You know, there's a medical protocol that's been funded by the FAA, and I'm aware of two twins that had a major incident in the United States not so long ago this year, and they had a terrible battle, just like Samantha was talking about, after the event, and they eventually rang the FAA and asked about this protocol that it heard about, and the people that they were speaking to didn't even have a clue that it was in existence within the FAA, that had paid for it. So there has to be an education process. There are steps that can be taken. There are experts that have dealt with Gulf War syndrome, and they, in the United States, have been funded to a huge extent by Congress, and they have the knowledge of what is going on wrong here. And if there was a will, as these people have said, steps could be taken to really look at the people, look at the evidence, and pull all of this together so that it could be recognized and solved. But at the moment, the airline industry has been too powerful to enable this to happen. And it is changing, though. And we want people to keep flying and business to keep on going, but not at passenger, crew, and crew health and safety's expense.
Captain Hoyt, what do you think they should do in England to help make it safer for the British passengers?
Okay, well, I think they know there's a problem. They would claim that they've been doing testing, but the trouble is this has been going on for years now, and we've been trying to get them to test aircraft on the ground to find out, for example, what the visible oil fumes are, which frequently happened in my experience. You know, there's lots of figures talked about how often these fume events occur, and the official figure is, say, 1 in 2,000, which is ridiculous, really. Many pilots report them much more frequently than that, at about 1 in 100. But I would argue that I had a fume event virtually every day I was flying. Often the cabin would fill with visible fumes on the ground, and And you know, that's not difficult to test. You know, I give me an aircraft, I can fill it with fumes. So why don't they know what's in these fumes? And I'm pretty sure that they, if they did the testing, they'd find well, you know, serious amounts of organophosphate. And that's what I breathed for all those years. And I know what caused my ill health. So it's about time they came clean. And you know, they're just playing for time at the moment, really.
Well, Judith, do you have any suggestions of what we should do here in the United States?
You know, that there's some legislation being considered by the House right now, looking at requirement to investigate bleed air filtration and monitoring, so to require an further investigation. And we would like to see that not only that research go forward to fine-tune the products that are already available, but also a requirement that these products be required on aircraft, so that the air that comes into the cabin is filtered before people are breathing it, and that the air is also monitored so that pilots can be informed during a flight if there's some oil in the air supply. So I encourage people to write to their representatives and to their senators. The senator is looking at similar language, and show support for that. But also, yeah, just that if this happens, to make sure to report it and to get the information that's available online about the blood test that's being developed that will enable people to prove exposure to engine oil. And then to network through the organizations, Toxic Free Airlines, aerotoxic.org, that have been mentioned, as well as the crew unions. Crew unions are working on this as well and want to hear from their members.
So in light of that and the fact that we're running out of time at this point, I'd like to go through each of you and giving your contact information. Captain Susan McKellis, do you want to give your contact information?
Yes, I can. I can be contacted through my website, www.susanmichaelis.com, or emailed at susan@susanmichaelis.com. And that's MICHAELIS. And I can also be contacted through gcaqe.org. And as I said, for additional information, the documentary Welcome Aboard Toxic Airlines is available. And that's available on its website.
Okay. And Captain John Hoyt, you want to give your website and contact information?
Yes, of course. It's www.aerotoxic, that's aero as in aeroplane, toxic as in toxic, .org, aerotoxic.org, and you can contact me through that site quite easily. It's all free. We're dedicated to getting the word out and helping people. There must be so many people out there suffering who don't really know why, and we'd especially welcome media attention because, you know, any media attention is helpful to us. And we believe people can protect themselves with face masks, for example. There's absolutely no protection at the moment on aircraft. People sit there expecting the drop-down oxygen mask to do that job, but it's not there for that purpose. It's there for decompression. So, you know, we're selling face masks on the site and having some success with that in an effort to protect people.
And Sue Dale, do you want to tell us about ToxicFreeAirlines.com?
Yep, as you said, it's ToxicFreeAirlines.com, and I can be contacted at Sue@ToxicFreeAirlines.com. We reply to every email. I'm getting emails every single day from sick crew who are suffering. As I said before, we have a register there, so crew and passengers can log any fume events. Quite often we have the situation where the crew members might know from the captain that there's been a fume event, but the passengers get off and they don't know. And now crew members are finding out about this register. They're putting the details on there so passengers can have a look to see if their flight is there. If not, they can register it, and they are able to private message each other so they can communicate about it now. And we also have on the front page the crew health survey. That's still ongoing. So any serving pilots and cabin crew can complete our health survey and give us their data. And you can also view the results of the first 640 surveys. The data has been collated, and that's available for anyone to view on the front of the website, which is ToxicFreeAirlines.com.
And we also have Judith Murawski. Do you want to tell us your...
Sure. The best email address for me is my first name, Judith, J-U-D-I-T-H, @afaseattle.org. That's Apple, Frank, Apple, seattle.org. And phone number is 206-932-6237. And that's in the States on Pacific time.
And that's in the United States. And Kate Hannai is the director of FlyersRights.org, FlyersRights.org. And she has a lot of information about this issue. And I'd also like to bring in Dan Henley. Are you still there, Dan? I guess he has left us. Oh, here he is. I have to click him on again.
Okay.
Okay, Dan.
Yes.
I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the Washington, D.C. September 22nd meeting.
Wonderful. That's why I was hoping Kate would be on. I knew it would be crowded with this many people on there, and she wound up being a good listener. And I hope she's still out there listening, because I want to plug what's happening on the passenger side here. Kevin Mitchell, who's runs the Business Travel Coalition, which is a global organization representing all business travelers out there, has formed an alliance with Kate and all the other passenger rights groups. And he just put out a press statement just a few days ago that's entitled Momentum Building for U.S. Passenger Rights Legislation. First, unintended consequences realized. Airlines need to come on board. And we put that out on our website and a number of other communications medium, but they're having this on September 22nd. Let me back up. On September 30th, the FAA reauthorization bill is going to be voted on. On September 22nd, they're having a huge press conference, and they've reserved a room in the Russell Senate office building in Washington, D.C., and they're going to have a wide panel of representatives from the passenger side, and they're going to have senators and congressmen there, and they're hoping to have a mainstream media news person that will be the moderator for this event. All the mainstream media press cameras will be rolling. If you go to this site, it's stakeholder hearing, stakeholder, one word, .eventbrite, and that's eventbrite.com. You have to register for the event. So when you get to that site, just look up in the upper right-hand corner. You'll see how you register for the event. And what they're hoping for here is this massive passenger and air crew support for this public forum where all these issues can be addressed. And one more thing that I had just briefly mentioned at the beginning when that other gent was in conversing with us, we are aligned with the we're working closely with the FAA Whistleblower Alliance, who is also working with Tom Devine, who's a legal director for the Government Accountability Project. And maintenance is a critical issue here because each airline does have a principal operation inspector, FAA type, who oversees this. And I just talked with Gabe Bruno, who's a representative for that group, the other night, and we're both in touch with Kate because we all recognize the synergies here. And hopefully anybody that's listening that's either in the D.C. area or if you can fly in, they're looking for max participation in this event because passengers are fed up with what's happening out there.
Okay, well, we're going to have to wrap it up here, Dan.
Okay.
And I'd like
thank
to
you
get
very much, Jeanette.
Some,
thank you for
some last words from Tony here. Tony, some last words of advice for any of our traveling passengers or crew might feel the effects of this toxic exposure.
I think the first thing is probably I've been in touch with the Aerotoxic Association, John Hoyt there, and I've been a member for a while. I'd suggest calling an association like that. They'll be very helpful in giving you advice what to do in terms of if you feel you're in a position to carry on flying or not. I mean, ultimately, that's got to be your own decision, I think, based on your own health, and if you think you're not safe enough to fly, it's really your responsibility to stop flying.
And John, do you have any last second? We have only 5 minutes to go.
Well, it's a difficult subject. You know, it's a so well guarded secret by the industry. People don't really understand it, and you know, we all have to come to terms with it one day. The day of the final flight. You know, how you deal with that. But I don't know. We can offer advice and an association spirit. You know, there's lots of people in the association now, and we, you know, we're there to help.
Well, let me let everyone know, this is Dr. Jeanette Parker, and I'm medical whistleblower, and we are an advocacy network for those who report problems within the medical community. Certainly, aerotoxic syndrome does qualify as a public health issue, and these are clearly transportation whistleblowers, but also medical whistleblowers. And medical whistleblower can be reached at medicalwhistleblower@gmail.com. And I really appreciated having you all on my show. This is an extremely important issue, and it is one that does need to be addressed, both from the standpoint of having our medical professionals recognize that there could be a toxic syndrome involved with anyone who has previously been on a plane and has unresolved health issues, and especially for the crew that fly regularly. So any last-minute statements, Dan?
I just want to thank you for hosting this and all the people in Seattle and Kate for taking the time from her busy schedule for coming up on, and particularly to my friends, our friends in the UK, who were very helpful in coordinating the efforts on that side of the pond. So thank you all for participating in this, and we all realize it's a serious issue that needs to be addressed by all parties with the evidence that's available out there.
And I thank you all for making that long-distance phone call to us. And I also want to invite every single transportation whistleblower, pilot, interested passenger to Medical Whistleblowers National Medical Whistleblower Conference, which is happening on September 11th through 13th this year here in Lawrence, Kansas. And you can get additional information by emailing me at medicalwhistleblower@gmail.com. And you can also leave a message at my Blog Talk Radio through chat or an email contact there. And so I look forward to perhaps hosting a good discussion of this kind of topics and about the value of having our whistleblowers be able to speak truth to power. It's very important that we protect their rights and that we listen very carefully to those who have knowledge about these kinds of problems and have risked their own careers to step forward and report the issues that are so important to passenger safety.
Jeanette, can I just inject one more comment here?
Mm-hmm.
Your programs are archived, so they can reference your site, go back and pick up the link. And if you're on Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn, Twitter, or you have your own website, it's strongly encouraged that you just post the link there just to try to heighten public awareness by every means available right now, because that will get it out in the media. That will bring the public outcry to a roar, hopefully, and we'll get an adequate response to the situation.
And we also suggest that you contact your elected officials to let them know that this is an issue that you feel that there should get their attention and that they should probably mandate the detection of these kinds of toxins in the air on airlines, and also to make sure that lead air that is sent to the cabin for passengers and crew to breathe is actually filtered in order to prevent further exposure. So that's a very important thing.
I agree.
So I want to thank all my guests for being on this show. And just to go through, we had Captain Susan Michaelis. She was calling in from the UK. She has many years of experience flying as an airplane pilot out of Australia. Kate Hannay, who is a U.S. representative of passenger rights. Captain John Hoyt, also from the U.K. Sue Dale, also from the U.K. And Samantha Sabatino. And Judith Murkowski, who is from our United States group, as well as a couple of persons who have been exposed, who shared their own experiences. And thank you very much. And this is Dr. Jeanette Parker, Michael, Medical Whistleblower.